ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Big Ideas today comes to you from the recent Sorrento Writers' Festival on the traditional lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nation. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell with a rollicking and very timely event off the back of the federal budget asking, is there an alchemy of good political leadership? Now, back in January, which kind of feels like a decade ago, doesn't it? Festival director Corey Perkin was inspired by Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, which went viral at the time. Here's a reminder.
It seems that every day we're reminded that we live in an era of great power rivalry, that the rules-based order is fading, that the strong can do what they can and the weak must suffer what they must. And this aphorism of Thucydides is presented as inevitable, as the natural logic of international relations reasserting itself. And faced with this logic, there is a strong tendency for countries to go along to get along, to accommodate, to avoid trouble, to hope that compliance will buy safety. Well, it won't.
And the Canadian Prime Minister also said, intermediate powers like Canada are not powerless. They have the capacity to build a new order that encompasses our values, such as respect for human rights, sustainable development, solidarity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the various states. The power of the less powerful starts with honesty. Well, the world responded with excitement. Was this a leader for our time, standing up to the bully across his border? Joining me for this session, to Mark Carney, you had me at hello, what does good leadership look like? Troy Branston, a senior journalist with The Australian and best-selling author of biographies about Australian prime ministers, including Bob Hawke, Robert Menzies, Paul Keating, and his newest is called Gough Whitlam, The Vista of the New. Jennifer Hewitt is a business journalist and national affairs columnist with The Australian Financial Review. And historian Paul Strangio is emeritus professor in politics at Monash University. His new book is called The Alchemy of Leadership, Seven Australian Prime Ministers in a Turbulent 21st Century. And it's out this month.
Let's give them a warm welcome. Did Mark Carney have you at hello? Troy Branston.
Look, it was one of those speeches that was a galvanising moment. You know, often we think about leaders in terms of what they do and what they achieve, but it's also important to think about how a leader makes us feel. And in that speech, he empowered all middle powers. And we're a middle power. Canada's a middle power. And there's a lot of bullies on the global stage at the moment. And he sort of gave voice to that empowerment idea, that sense of our own destiny, our own opportunity, our own place in the world. So I think it did resonate. And of course, Canada's been besieged by Donald Trump. He's threatened to invade the country, to annex it, to take it over. So the context of giving a speech is also important. So Canada's a bit more kind of imperiled than we are. Mm. But he spoke to a moment, and often words from leaders can illustrate, explain, furnish a moment in time. And that's what he did with that speech. So it is important, and it marks his sort of big arrival on the world stage. He was, some of you might remember, he was elected partly as an anti-Trump candidate. His opponent was seen as, well, sorry, re-elected. His opponent was seen as a sort of a pro-Trump candidate. So it's sort of come at that moment. And I think it's been sort of galvanising for other middle powers to think about where they are and how we should be treated.
And strategic that he lands in Australia not long after, building an alliance with Australia. Jennifer Hewitt, you know, his line, "The power of the less powerful starts with honesty." He was dropping some truth bombs. He was doing some, speaking some difficult truths. Did he have you at hello?
Well, he certainly got a lot of attention with that speech because, as Troy said, you know, it came at a particular moment, and what he said out loud was what many, many countries, including all the Europeans, as well as many people in Australia, of course, thought the same thing. It was basically, "We don't like Trump, and you're a dreadful person and you're a bully, etc." And so everybody went, "Yay, that's fantastic." In terms of the application of the middle power stuff, yes, of course, much of it does make sense. And there were some, you know, lines like, you know, "If you're not at the table, you're on the menu," that type of... So all of that resonates. What it actually means, though, in real life is a lot more difficult. Mm. And so, yes, the rhetorical speech is fine, and yes, there are naturally middle powers should work together as much as they can and try and align their interests as much as they can, etc., and stand up for things. But to suggest that there's going to be some new world order that actually incorporates a coherent and cohesive group of middle power countries with a great deal of influence... is I think a little optimistic. And
a little optimistic or La La Land?
Well, a bit La La Land, frankly. And I mean, you'd note that he in that speech, he talked a lot about, you know, the wonderful, you know, adherence to the rule of law. Now, he, along with Albanese, while they were here, were the first leaders to get up pretty well and say the bombing of Iran was a great, you know, was a good thing.
Was that good leadership?
Well, I think it just shows the difference between saying and doing. Mm. And in one other area, or a couple of other areas, the other thing was, of course, he is a very popular leader. I think he's a very effective leader. But one of the reasons he is a very effective leader is he has come in as Trudeau's successor. As Troy said, he really won because he was the anti-Trump candidate and did that very well. And he's also got very good credentials. But he's now, as in government, actually trashed Trudeau's left of centre government style. I mean, he's the one who's gotten rid of the carbon tax. He's slashed immigration. He's now, despite the fact that he was always associated with climate change action, he's the one who's now talking about more oil and gas development. So, I mean, all and of which, I'm not saying doesn't make him not a good leader.
But I was just going to say, some people might think that, well, that's decisive.
Yes, leadership. Well, I think he has been very good like that, but it just means that words and what you say beforehand don't necessarily correspond with reality in government.
Interesting. Some people, Paul Strangio, might think that that was kind of foolish bravado, what Mark Carney did on the world stage. And so I'm interested in your response, but also then thinking as a contrast perhaps to the way our Prime Minister, Albanese, has navigated this time and the alliance with the USA in a sort of say less mode.
Yeah, I was really puzzled, actually, to some degree with the infatuation with Mark Carney from that moment, because I think Jennifer's just noted, in essence, he's a technocrat. I don't think he's an especially inspirational leader. So, yes, he captured a moment, and that's part of what leadership is about. It's about that the opportunities there. He grasped it. He articulated something. He articulated it very well. But I think it left out the broader picture of Mark Carney and his persona. And the other thing, I think one of the reasons why it struck here, not only are we also a middle power like Canada, but of course the juxtaposition against Anthony Albanese. Anthony Albanese's got a lot of strengths as a leader, and the sort of nudging around as he's managed international relations, I think, is an example of that. But what he doesn't have a particular strength in is a faculty with words. You know, there's a longing, I still think, for someone who has a capacity of powerful advocacy, and it's something that Anthony Albanese lacks. So I think it was that juxtaposition. I think Albanese actually knows he doesn't have that capacity and he's accepted it. I think The Voice was a moment that really brought that home as well, that that's something missing from his leadership repertoire. And I think afterwards, after The Voice, it took him time to regroup as a leader because it exposed that deficiency in his leadership repertoire.
Yeah, this balance between outward-focused charisma and communication and then what happens behind the scenes. You know, a person can be a great leader behind the scenes but not great at articulating their leadership. And so, Troy, I'm interested in your reflections on that tension, because that's been played out across Australia, the history of Australian politics, in very interesting ways, hasn't it? Julia Gillard, you know, she didn't really want to kind of play around with the onstage charisma as much. But behind the scenes, by all reports, she was a very good supporter of her team, builder of her team, collegiate, consensus builder. But that wasn't sort of talked about on the public stage as much.
Yeah, it's the unseen aspect of the prime ministership. And I've come to the view that it's really important for a prime minister to be a good manager of a team. They've got to manage their party. They've got to manage their cabinet. They've got to stage policy development and articulate policy. They've got to manage an enormous amount of paperwork, get across issues. A lot of these things are unseen. And if they're not done well, so remember Kevin Rudd, then soon it'll become public.
Chaos behind the scenes.
That's right. And so when I was writing about Gough Whitlam, I was writing about someone who was a very dynamic, inspirational, innovative political leader who left an enormously vast legacy in such a short period of time. But the way he ran the government was chaotic and shambolic and perpetually dysfunctional. I mean, he had a disdain for the caucus. He had a contempt for the cabinet. He ignored public service advice. And when I went through a lot of memos from public servants and advice in the archives, you know, they were saying things like, you're at risk of being dismissed. During the supply crisis, he ignored that. They told him not to deal with Tirath Kemlani on the US $4 billion overseas loan. So he ignored a lot of that advice. And so he has part of the package of what makes a good leader. And so Albanese is kind of like the reverse of Whitlam, where when I've interviewed Albanese, he really emphasises that he is leading a stable government, a united government, a process-driven government. They believe in proper cabinet processes. They listen to public service advice. They use cabinet as a clearinghouse. He's very collegiate with his caucus colleagues. The door's always open. He talks to the opposition leader. But he's lacking what Whitlam lacked, which was the ambition and the boldness and the ability to communicate an animating program for the nation. So you've got to have the combination of the two, the program and the sort of ability to talk about it, and the behind-the-scenes kind of mechanics. I just quickly end with a comment that I discovered that Gough Whitlam made as his government was sort of unravelling in 1975. The caucus, it was very restless. Caucus would often overturn policy decisions from cabinet. And the cabinet members wanted to talk to him about how the government was travelling. And he quickly called a halt to the discussion in the cabinet room. He scanned the eyes of his ministers and he said, listen, you blokes, this government has one thing going for it and you're looking at it. So that's not good leadership.
Which makes me think, Jennifer Hewitt, that tension between, and we might come to the foundations of self-belief in a minute because mothers are a consistent theme here, but that tension between self-belief and hubris, ego, and then the need to suppress ego. How important is that in good leadership, to curate your ego?
Yes, well, I was very interested. I went to another session here with Ben Crowe, who's a kind of a terrific leadership psychologist in many ways. And he was talking about one of the aspects of leadership being both humble and hungry. And I thought, I'm not quite sure how that would work with somebody like Paul Keating, for example. But anyway.
What never humble?
Never humble, really, and or showing vulnerability. You know, I didn't quite see that.
But hungry for reform.
But yeah, but definitely hungry for reform. And I think on that theme, we all hear and talk a lot about the Hawke-Keating reforms. One of the things about Bob Hawke, one of the many things about him, was that he was actually very good at leading a team. They were talented individuals, and that, of course, is another aspect, I think, of the Albanese government that you might have a few problems with. But in the Hawke era, there were some very talented individuals, and, of course, the most paramount example of that was Paul Keating, and he was able to do a lot of things. But what you understood about Hawke's leadership was not only was that he was incredibly personable and could sell a message in a way to people and connect with people so brilliantly, but he allowed people like to lead a team very, very well and gave them the freedom to do so, and yet it was a cohesive whole. That, I think, is a great skill as a leader, which probably we don't quite recognise. And in a sense, although Keating, of course, we all talk about Keating as leader, I mean, really, I think his most important, reforms and what we most remember him for pretty well, and certainly in terms of the economy, was when he as treasurer under Hawke.
Mm. We'll come back to whether you think Keating could thrive as a leader today, because how to be a good leader has possibly changed because the context in which people have to lead has so radically changed. Paul Strangio, you immersed yourself in the alchemy of leadership, and you think there is an alchemy to leadership, partly because you were also interested in this idea of the good man theory, the great man theory,
the great
of leadership.
Man theory. Thomas Carlyle got it. Was the famous, it reached its apotheosis in a work in the 19th century.
And I mean, I guess there's lots to say about that other than that it strips women from the history of leadership, which is, fairly important to acknowledge. But what was the interest for you in this idea? Yeah.
Well, I came to this book, my new book, because there's been a perennial debate among historians, what shapes the world? On the one hand, one extreme was the notion of the great man makes the world, and by and large it's been men, we have to say. Opposed to that was the view that all of us are really controlled by impersonal forces, the conditions in which we operate. Also, in liberal democracies, leaders are enmeshed in institutions. So that downplays the capacity of leaders to shape the world. So two different sort of viewpoints. But when I looked around the globe in recent times, and we see a number of populist strongmen roiling the world, and we have to look no further than the White House to see probably the most pronounced example. But there's Putin, Xi Jinping in China, and so on and so on. So I was reflecting that debate seems quaint to me. What we're seeing, we're getting a remedial lesson right now in the capacity of leaders, and I think particularly those on the sort of the bad, mad spectrum, those who are on that, to, shape the world and to disturb the world, to disrupt the world. And what it seems to me, therefore, we're at a moment where there's a real imperative to dig into understanding leaders, to what motivates them, what turns them into the sort of leaders they are, their belief systems, their styles of leadership. And to me that requires, and I think as citizens, there's a demand. We should be concerned and interested in the backgrounds of our leaders. So I think it does demand some attention to their psychological making. Mm. As I've grown older, I'm more and more persuaded of that. Leaders are created, and by looking at their formative years, we get a very good idea of what sort of leader they'll be.
Although you wonder whether sometimes focusing on their formative years means that we don't allow them to transcend the crucible of their life.
But I'll take that up because we were talking about ego. Narcissism is another way to say this. And all leaders are generally narcissists. It's just most of us wouldn't be leaders. We don't have that in us. But narcissism, there's good and bad narcissism. Actually, narcissism is associated with creativity. Hawke's a classic example. You know, he radiated self-love, but he was so comfortable in his own skin, he could enable others. He could share power. Now, Rudd, his narcissism is of a different kind. It's a wounded narcissism because of a very difficult childhood that only became apparent when he wrote his memoir, which is so affecting about his childhood.
Tell us more.
Well, it's all about the story of his father, an ne'er-do-well who was a struggler, became a drinker, was losing money. Kevin's the last of four children at home. His mother begins to confide in him about her concerns. They're going to lose the farm. He's about 8 or 9 years old. The father continues to drink. There's violence, it seems, in the household. And then one day, after a day of drinking, his father goes off the road and then lingers for 3 weeks in hospital dying. And Kevin and the mother are visiting him, observing him die. And then when he does, Kevin's mother has to go out to work. So Kevin's farmed out to relatives in different places. It's a terribly wounding, traumatic childhood. And his life is a triumph over adversity. But I think that lack of a firm taming of the soul, which is a phrase I use, that
from Max Weber, theorist,
it became evident in his prime ministership because it's a wounded narcissism, so he hogs power. He's a controller. He can't share power. So again, I think he's...
And very demanding of others.
Very demanding of others. And his answer to everything was to work harder. I'll just work harder and harder. And it doesn't work. Mm. It's not a sustainable operating style. So again, I think those roots are there.
Oh, fascinating.
And you can read more of political historian Paul Strangio's compelling reflections in his new book out this month, The Alchemy of Leadership, Seven Australian Prime Ministers in a Turbulent 21st Century. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, Natasha Mitchell joining you from the Sorrento Writers' Festival today. Also with Australian Financial Review journalist Jennifer Hewitt and prolific political biographer and journalist with The Australian, Troy Bramston.
Troy Bramston, made or born good leadership? You have the forensic detail in your biographies is just so compelling, and particularly this linking theme of the role of maternal care, often in the face of adversity, but not all the time, for particularly Australian prime ministers, which made me think I want to read every political biography in the entire world about every prime minister. But just reflect on that for us, this linking theme.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that mostly leaders are made, but, you know, it's interesting when I've interviewed more than 10 prime ministers, and I've always asked them this question: do you think leaders are made or they're born? And they all said, there's an element that they're born with. There's a special quality that they have that's innate.
Temperament.
Yeah, it could be lots of things. I mean, for Bob Hawke, of course, he was told from the moment he was a baby that it was his destiny to lead the nation. And so that fueled his industrial and political career. For him, it was a matter of destiny. That's what it was. And so the reason I subtitled my biography of him, Demons and Destiny, is because his life became a struggle between the demons, the womanising, the adultery, the drinking, the emotional outbursts, the tears, the temper, and this destiny. And so he's in a constant struggle between the two of them. And so his life was, in a way, preordained. With Whitlam, I saw him as a figure of history. He's a change agent in the sense that he sees himself as someone who has to take the wheel of history and turn the nation in a new direction. So for Hawke, his his motivation is the personality. It's him. He's going to lead the nation. It's all about him. And so, in, you know, his great thing was to promise consensus leadership. And that meant he's at the centre of everything. With Whitlam, it was the Whitlam program. It was the policies. It was urban and regional development. It was education. It was health. It was law reform. It was the program that was emblematic for Whitlam. Whereas for Hawke, it was him himself. But the constant theme I've found, getting back to your question, is... and Paul's done a lot of work on this too, is, you know, the early life of somebody is really important in shaping where they're going to go. And so I found in my four biographical subjects, I mean, by and large, not exactly, but with Menzies, Whitlam, Hawke and Keating, they both had very loving, supportive upbringings. There might have been some tension, some difficulties, as there are in all upbringings, but mostly they had a loving and supportive framework to begin their life. But then you look at some of the other prime ministers between them. So Holt, Gorton, McMahon had very disruptive childhoods, early parental deaths, farmed out to live with other people, difficult life. And so I wonder whether that has had an impact on them. They weren't as effective as those other prime ministers. But yeah, I mean, they live with this, you know, and it's really interesting. I mean, I've been very lucky to interview these prime ministers at length. And I just always remember I did the last ever interview with Bob Hawke at his home. I didn't know it was going to be the last interview, but he died a few months later. And again, he teared up when he was talking about his father. You know, his father was a congregational preacher. And Hawke said to me, he was my best friend and I loved him. And he was the finest person I'd ever met. And so he had this really strong connection with his father right at the end of his life. That's where his thoughts were going. Mm. And for Keating, it was the same. And for Whitlam as well, in interviews he gave, you know, he talked about his parents. And so it's really interesting in how they sort of design their public life in homage often to their parents because they want to repay what they've given them. And
perhaps sometimes what the parents haven't had an opportunity to experience themselves. If you think about those single mothers of Albanese and Rudd and there's someone else as well, but, you know, that there's a sense that they, you know, that they pour all that energy into their sons and their sons do the things that their mums couldn't have done.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we find these are very, very formative influences. I just wanted to make a quick point about Paul Keating because I talked to him a lot about his parents and his father died, I think, when he was in his 20s, but his father was very influential, but his mother lived a very, very long life. And so they gave him a sort of a great supportive framework for him to get involved in Labor politics at an early age. And he would tell me that his grandmother and his mother had given him this sort of suit of armour to wear out into the world. You might have heard this, Paul.
An asbestos suit,
yeah.
to walk through the fire. It's a beautiful...
Did Mum put it like that?
Keating put it like that. Yeah, it's one of those lines only Keating had come up with. Asbestos suit to walk through the fire of politics and be untouched.
And so the point of that is that he's saying that when he's suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, the assaults on him, he's thinking about the love of his mother and his grandmother in particular. And that's what is sustaining him forward. Just a quite quickly related to that, when I was interviewing him for the biography, I said to him, you know, a lot of people have told me you're not like the public person. You're a doting father, you're a good husband, you're a very soft and gentle person. But public rarely sees that. All they see is the brawler, you know, the great repartee in Parliament, the savage attacks on his opponents. We know them all. And he said, listen, Troy, what you've got to understand is for 25 years in Parliament, I gave the country my brain and I wasn't going to give them my soul. And the reason he's saying that is because I was saying, you know, why didn't we see more of your family life? Why didn't we see more of your son and your daughters and the other side of you? And he said, that was off limits. I'd given the country enough and I wasn't going to open them into that door.
Which is a skill, because you've got to protect something of yourself to be a good leader, don't you?
Well, Bob Hawke didn't. Bob Hawke let everyone know everything about his life. Bob Hawke's, you know, womanising was on industrial scale, as I alluded to earlier. He would cry on television He would get angry on television. He'd bang the table at press conferences. I mean, Jennifer would remember some of these things. He lived his life out large with nothing hidden. The public drinking, I mean, I was born in 1975, but I'm reading accounts of him, you know, totally blind at the Trades Hall Hotel or, you know, some of these pubs around Australia. The womanising was all seen. Everything was out
it
in the open.
It makes Barnaby's sort of situation fairly mediocre, really.
Barnaby looks tame compared to
Pretty damn Paul. Tame. Jennifer, that's interesting, isn't it? And so it makes me think also about the role of authenticity in good leadership. You know, Australians smell a rat when someone's not authentic. Scott Morrison was an interesting example of that, wasn't it? You know, that tension between, you know, how authentic was he on the public stage?
Well, I think he clearly, in the way he ended his prime ministership, very, very much disliked.
Minister of everything.
Yeah, and I also think he just demonstrated that he never really connected with the people in a way that they respected, and which, you know, for him, I'm sure, was shocking. But, you know, the famous "I don't hold a hose, mate," all of that stuff just followed him. Some of it, I thought, was unfair. For example, the fact that he obviously didn't get women at all, really, in any kind of political way. But the way that the whole Brittany Higgins thing was weaponized, as though he was almost personally responsible, was outrageous. But it stuck. So I'm not sure, really, whether you call that lack of authenticity or... But people just didn't trust him.
Trust
him in the end. And I think if you look, like, to Albanese now, it's interesting to me that the words he uses all the time are calm, orderly, process-driven, as Troy said, but there's no sense, really, of what he's about. And so, yes, he's authentic... to people, but he's kind of authentically ordinary. Now, yes, there's a certain strength in that type of stability for people, but
especially after a decade of tumult.
Yeah, that's right, and because there's so much turmoil and everything. So some people, you know, a lot of people would say, well, you know, calm, fine, there's nothing wrong with calm. But it certainly leaves the idea lacking of what he's on about and where the government's going, and I don't think there's any sense of direction there. He has been... an extraordinarily fortunate, lucky politician in the sense that the implosion of the coalition, you know, is extraordinary. So that helps him a lot.
Will it sustain?
Yeah, but I think the kind of professionalisation of politics, and you understand why. We'll talk about it maybe later, but, you know, the rise of social media, the fact that everything can be just kind of cut and pasted and shown on video instantly, you have to become more protective, I think, because so much can be distorted. But I'm not sure that you get much of a sense of Albanese's direction at all, and I think that is a problem in terms of authenticity eventually.
And that kind of social media exposure, and we will go there, I think, pretty much now, but that can diminish someone's courage in leadership as well, I imagine.
Yeah, but I don't think Albanese was ever there. I mean, I don't think he's ever had a big... I mean, the only thing that he really said that he wanted to do, for example, was The Voice in the end, and that obviously didn't work, and then he's really run away from that. He just doesn't even... We don't even speak about that anymore. In terms of big changes for the country, well, he's fortunate in a sense that the Labor vision of more manufacturing, more protectionism, that actually suits... That's a kind of global trend at the moment. So he's kind of slotted into that very well. How it works and how efficiently it is done is another matter. If you look at where... If they were to lose government today, which they won't anytime soon, where would you see? You'd see it's still a kind of fairly sullen electorate for all sorts of reasons. You'd see The Voice, which didn't go anywhere. He has certainly been very good at emphasising his government support for women, like, again, in complete contrast to the image of the Morrison government.
Well, it was partly because by having actually women in the cabinet.
Well, yes, you know, and
it's a good start.
Yes, and he promotes that all the time, and that, I think, is very effective for him. But of course, the other strange thing is, compared to decades ago, where women tended to be the more conservative, you know, vote for the Liberals, etc. It's the complete reverse now. It's you know, and so again, he's quite lucky in that kind of change in demographics too.
What about the increasing sort of presidentialisation? I think that's a word, of leaders and that kind of expectation. I'm interested in a comment from you all on that, that kind of the central focus on the leader rather than the team. Is that consequential? Does anyone want to comment on that? Paul Strangio?
It's a long-term trend. And again, I'd probably identify, as you do with so much in Australian politics, as Gough Whitlam as being the first, the great modernist, and the focus on Whitlam, the 1972 campaign, the use of advertising to humanise him. And then you've got, it's been a revolutionary trend. For example, I'd identify John Howard as the one who centralised power, particularly the use of cabinet subcommittees, which he would dominate, the growth of the...
So the illusion of a broad church, yeah, but the reality
the illusion
wasn't the
of
case.
A broad church. I think the notion of a broad church under Howard is a myth. But leaving that aside, the Prime Minister's office and the amount of control it wields, the centrality of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Can I just go to Albanese for a moment? Look, I think Albanese is fascinating because, again, to use Max Weber's 1919 essay, which is, I think still has resonance, a great leader, according to him, had a combination of proportion. And I think Albanese's got that, all that stuff about order, you know, working through things and control and measured. And that comes of being in politics for so long. Remember, it took him 25 years to become Prime Minister.
And it strikes me that, and all of you have commented on this, I think, in your work, but there's a long apprenticeship for some of the most successful leaders.
And generally speaking...
Keating.
And
nobody expected him to become Prime Minister.
No.
At all.
So Howard,
his
Keating.
Mother, probably.
Yeah, right.
And he sat a lot in the Parliament for around a dozen years watching Howard and clearly observed a lot of lessons from Howard, another dogged, incremental sort of leader. Though the difference is, I think Howard did know how he wanted to shape the country, and Weber said you've got to have also an element of the heroic, warm passion in your repertoire. Now that remains the big question mark about Anthony Albanese. What I would say, I wonder if we're at an inflection point in the government right at the moment that they're finally saying this is the opportunity is now to start to strike out. People like Chalmers are pushing behind the scenes. It's often struck me that Chalmers is too much of a team player, too congenial, and what this government lacks is a Keating, a bomb, internal bomb thrower.
Yeah, but that's partly,
constantly.
But that's partly because he wants to be liked by everyone because he wants to become leader himself.
Yes, but Keating didn't. He was an internal agitator.
Yes.
And he also, behind the scenes, he called Bob Hawke old jellyback. Now, I don't think Chalmers says that. I think there's a genuine actual rapport between those two, but that's what the government seemingly lacks, a bit of agitation to move.
I don't think there's that much rapport, really.
No.
No, but anyway.
You're at Sorrento Writers Festival with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen with me, Natasha Mitchell, where we're asking, what does good political leadership look like? Close watchers of politics, journalists Jennifer Hewitt, Troy Bramston and historian Emeritus Professor Paul Strangio are joining me on the stage.
Decentering leadership from the Prime Minister role, but do you see other leaders, examples of good leaders in government right now, Jennifer?
Well, for example, if we're looking at at state governments, for example, I think in terms of people who've grown into the job, they were a question mark when they started. You've got Chris Minns in New South Wales and you've obviously got Malinauskas in South Australia, and they've got that combination of being seen to run reasonable governments, but also have that kind of appeal and passion and be able to rise to the moment when needed.
The intervention in the Adelaide Writers' Week, notwithstanding, but anyway.
Well, we can have different there. Views on that, actually.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah, no, sure,
I won't go there.
Yep.
But, for example, after the Bondi massacre, I think Minns, it took him a couple of days, but eventually he met the moment very, very well, and people really responded to that. Albanese clearly did not.
Although there seemed to be a receptivity to Minns that there wasn't to Albanese at that time. People were booing him.
Yes, but I mean, that's because he didn't, like, he hadn't said anything, you know, that night. I mean, we all remember. And the next day it was, where is he? I mean, unlike, for example, the Port Arthur, we've got, what of that? It's the 30-year anniversary this week.
Yeah.
You know, John Howard on that in national tragedy again was there. Said the right things at that time.
Yeah. And you made the interesting point about leaders growing in the role, being flexible, learning in leadership, in the context of being leaders.
Yeah. And I think it is possible that you do have leaders who grow in the role and kind of take on the role. And we've seen the professionalisation of politics and certainly the professionalisation of the Labor Party as opposed to the disintegration of the coalition. But I'm not sure, and we've seen Albanese grow in the sense that he manages, he's very good at managing things. I'm not sure about leading things.
Just on that, I think politics is a learning profession, and it's a point that I've often made. And I've been able to interview Tony Blair a few times, and he told me a great comment, which was that he said that when he became British Prime Minister in 1997, he was at his most popular but knew the least about how government operated. And by 2007, he was at his least popular but knew the most about how government operated. So that's a flaw in the system. And he's very interesting about political leadership and how you kind of learn on the job. Just to, related to that, you know, it's interesting that some of these leaders weren't always that popular. We kind of think that they were, and particularly before they got the job. So, you know, Gough Whitlam was often seen as a very divisive, very polarising figure in the community, but also in the Labor Party. And a lot of people were very opposed to his rise through Labor ranks. And one colleague once said to him, the party won't take you because they love you, they'll take you because they need you. Two other examples. Hawke, a lot of his colleagues in 1983 when he took the leadership from Bill Hayden were really uncertain about how he would go. I just always remember Susan Ryan telling me, you know, this was a risky enterprise for us. Hawke was popular in the community and seen as inevitable and had the destiny thing, but, you know, they were worried about the womanising, they were worried
drinking.
About the drinking. He'd given up drink when he went into Parliament, but they were still worried about it. And so he sort of confounded expectations about the kind of leader he'd be. And the last example I wanted to make was Robert Menzies. He's probably the greatest example of somebody learning on the job. So you'd all know Menzies was Prime Minister between 1939 and 1941 and then lost the Prime Ministership. His colleagues turned against him quite savagely to boot him out. And then he reinvented himself and formed the Liberal Party. He gave the Forgotten People speech before that, which became a kind of a lodestar for the party and still is. And then he went on to lead for 16 years in government. And there was a good story I came across writing his biography where in that period between 41, when he lost the Prime Ministership, and before he'd formed the Liberal Party, he came across a colleague who said to him, you know, Bob, I've been interestingly watching you and I know you're trying to come back in politics, but the biggest problem you've got is that you don't suffer fools gladly. And Menzies looked at him and said, well, what do you think I'm doing now? So the point is that politics is a learning profession, right? And you've got to keep growing, you've got to keep learning.
But it's interesting to me that where so much of this discussion, obviously, is about Hawke and Keating. We've had a lot of prime ministers who were immediately, you know, prior to Albanese, and they don't kind of get much of a mention. Now, why is that? Well, clearly, in terms of people's expectations, you had Malcolm Turnbull, incredibly popular. The whole
charismatic,
you know, breathe a sigh of relief almost. Oh, you know, we're going to have somebody who's terrific, kind of coming into the prime ministership. This will be great. Well, you know, very shortly after he
politics.
Almost lost an election, and then not long after that he was deposed. So
and Tony Abbott as well, Jennifer. I mean, he won an election.
Yeah.
You know, he was a mixed figure in the community, I guess, mixed views about him. But he won an election and then it went down south pretty fast.
Quickly. Yeah,
same
not least because of Malcolm undermining him, but met plenty of some of his own work as well.
Paul wanted to pick up on something.
Oh, there's a lot of things I could pick up on there. I would say one, Laurie Oakes said of John Howard, and John Howard, of course, is the fountainhead of 21st century Australian politics. And part of my argument in this book is that we have lived under the Howard Project. I've wondered, are we finally at the end of Howardism, and if the 2025 election announced the end of Howardism?
In terms of his influence on policies sustained?
I don't think actually we are, because I think Labor has internalised aspects of Howardism and the Liberal Party continues to be wedded to it. But it's really been a story of doubling down on Howard throughout the 21st century.
In what
particularly
respect?
Under leaders like Tony Abbott, and I think the other one was Peter Dutton, to try to emulate the Howard model, but they were not good at it. They didn't
what
have
do you mean by the Howard model?
Well,
briefly,
the strong leadership mode that he really developed from 2001, scepticism about climate change, hard on borders. There's a whole lot of features of it, and they doubled down on that project, but they weren't good at it. It's a sort of what I'd describe in a nutshell as conservative populism. And part of my argument in this book is that Howard smuggled into Australian politics a level of conservative populism in the beginning of the 21st century, and ultimately, and the panel might disagree with me, that is a very difficult, if you like, virus to control, and we're now seeing it destroying the Liberal Party, partly because his successors, though doubling down on it, distilling it, have not had the same dexterity that he did. And I finished the last chapter by quoting Oscar Wilde, that people often destroy the thing they love. And my argument is that Howard's legacy is now destroying the Liberal Party. And that's part of my argument.
Jennifer.
Well,
And I think Jennifer might disagree.
I do. I do disagree with that. There are many aspects of it. But one of the things I will say is that you talked about John Howard in terms of climate change and in terms of hard borders. Well, there's been a mood shift that has gone on, and I think the coalition was in fact destroyed in many ways all the time by their whole argument about climate change, their internal, and I see in the audience my friend Marianne Wilkinson, who wrote The Carbon Club, of course, about all of that. But there's also been a global change in the world now. And so, yes, everybody goes, yes, climate change is really important. But by the way, we need oil and gas, and we need it at affordable prices. Now, that is a global phenomenon, and that is happening everywhere, and Mark Carney is certainly not the only one who's changed his tune dramatically. Similarly, hard borders. You know, Howard got a lot of criticism for that, but look at the debate about immigration in the world now. I mean, it's pretty tough. And I think in that you've got to see that context. What I do think is going to be interesting now with the Liberal Party, and it's a bit of a problem for how the Liberals try and develop now, you see Angus Taylor, in a sense, trying to hold on to that basically faith of sorts in the free market and, you know, the private sector, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got Andrew Hastie, you know, waiting to take over from him, and you've got the Nationals, and you've got this feeling of in One Nation saying, no, that's not good enough. We want all sorts of other things. So
okay.
I think this.
So we're not going to. There's a few things I want to round off on good leadership. But do you want a quick comment? Very quick.
I didn't articulate that very well. What I think, Howard, and a scene I use early in the book is Howard when he volunteered for Billy McMahon's campaign in 1972, working the auto cue, the manual auto cue. And what my argument is in that book, the book partly, is Howard's was an anti-modernist project. And now we see today, after, you know, 2025, the Liberal Party has had it, to some degree, has had its finger in the dike for this century, trying to hold back the tide of a certain type of social movements, identity politics, and now young people don't understand that party.
Yeah.
Young people who've been raised in diversity see it as second nature. They now don't recognise the Liberal Party.
So on that point, and there's two things I want to round off with. One of them is the ability of leaders to, you know, some people see good leadership as dividing a population in a way. They might not sort of articulate it like that, but it's how they lead. And we probably saw that with Dutton. Others are kind of about kind of bringing together of the community rather than a separation or leaning into people's fears about the other or the, you know, foreigners or refugees or... So I want to just touch on that, but I also want to just round off on what you think the leaders of the future need to do differently perhaps in order to be good leaders, because the current context of for leadership is a tough one. It's a 24/7 media cycle. It's social media. It's Paul Kelly's forthcoming biography, political book, you know, really looks at the way in which power has shifted from governments to social media, you know, just big tech. So this is a very complex environment within which to lead. So I'd love your reflections on that too. So those two points, if you could kind of go there in some way. Troy.
Leadership qualities are often timeless, right? So I made the point yesterday that a leader needs a port to seek, and they need a course to chart, right? So you've got to have a vision. It sounds obvious, it sounds pretty straightforward, it sounds pretty simple, but it's hard. And you've got to know who you are. Authenticity is really important. You've got to allow the public to get to know you and understand your strengths. And you need to have a vision for where you want to take the nation and explain why you want to get there. So,
but does the media cycle and does the sort of gotcha coverage of the press gallery allow for that articulation now?
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, I do think politics is harder now than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. I do think it's harder. That doesn't mean that those prime ministers that we see regard as generally successful would not succeed today, because I tend to think most of them would be able to adapt. But we have had big changes in our politics in the past. I mean, radio and television were seismic, right? And so just a quick point about television, came to Australia in 1956, quite late actually, in terms of the other world. But a lot of these politicians like Doc Evatt or Arthur Corwell struggled on television. And that's what really killed their political careers. Whereas Robert Menzies, who had been a great orator and very good on radio, adjusted to the new medium of television very successfully. So there's a lesson there in being able to adjust to new mediums to continue to sell your message. Yes, there's a lot of misinformation, there's disinformation, there's an overwhelming amount of information, but there's never been more vehicles to express a message, to get a message across. Politicians can now communicate with someone very directly, one-on-one, whether it's a text message, an email, an Instagram post. So you've got to be able to adapt to that. There's no point, you know, railing against the new politics. You just got to learn to adapt to that. Or have
teams around you that support you to do that, you know.
You do.
Or do it for you.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, it gets back to the immediate things. I mean, we can all say that, you know, like, for example, I mean, Gough Whitlam's program was all about modernisation. He called it the backlog. So he had a whole raft of things that he wanted to do. For Hawke and Keating, it was about the modernisation of the economy, opening Australia to the world, introducing a social safety net and things like that. For Menzies, it was the forgotten people framework, the middle classes and post-war growth. So it's pretty easy to sort of pigeonhole what these governments were doing and why they were doing it. I don't really know what is the message of the Albanese government. I don't know what their central mission, their purpose is. They need a kind of a catchphrase.
Progressive patriotism?
Well, what is that? I mean, that's a whole other session. So it is more difficult, but it's not impossible. And it gets back to those fundamental principles about being a leader and having a vision and identifying where you want to go and why.
Jennifer.
I think it is harder. And I agree with your point, Troy, that it's possible to reach people far more directly than you could before. But at the same time, the whole landscape is so fractured. And the days when you could have a kind of a national conversation and almost direct that national conversation through talking, frankly, to as a political leader, talking to, you know, half a dozen senior journalists in the press gallery. Those days are gone. I think it's much harder to kind of get that kind of coherent message. Having said that, I thought it was very funny when everybody kind of was waited to hear, what was it, the address to the nation the other night? And everyone went, they all got agitated about it.
And did it deliver for you?
What was that about? What was that about? But the other thing is, look, I understand your view about, yes, a whole younger generation doesn't understand the Liberal Party, the finger in the dyke and stuff. But don't forget, there's also a very substantial portion of the population, and they're not all older. They are very patriotic, and they don't like the identity politics or the fact that Australia is blamed for a whole lot of things, and you know, our history is something to be ashamed of. And I think One Nation is speaking to that, but it is not just people who don't understand or they're old-fashioned or whatever. I think there is actually a yearning for accepting a lot of, you know, things that were done really, really terribly in our history, but also being proud of the country. And I think you have to respond to that as well. Now, the Liberals might not have done it very well, but I think there is a bit of a reaction to identity politics going on.
And cool. Yes, and I agree. One of Albanese's weaknesses, he hasn't spoken to national identity. And our great prime ministers have tended to talk about national identity, and Albanese hasn't. Can I just say, I suppose on a glass half full note, if we're ending,
yep.
I think, yes, at one level, leadership's got more difficult, undoubtedly. Changing media landscape, the major parties not... diminishing hold on the electorate, you know, the fracturing. However, leadership tends to move in cycles. And there's the great Donald Horne aphorism that Australia was a lucky country run by second-rate people. I don't think that's true. If you look at the sweep of history, Australia has had its fair share of accomplished leaders. Prime ministers like Alfred Deakin, Andrew Fisher early, the middle of the 20th century, John Curtin, Ben Chifley, Robert Menzies. More recently, Whitlam, Hawke, Keating, Howard. I certainly think Howard is a very significant and accomplished Prime Minister, even though I have questions about his legacy. So it moves in cycles, and I think, you know, another big transformative leader moment will come. I still have some optimism for Albanese if he can grow.
Would the next big leader be a woman? Troy, Jennifer, Paul?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we haven't had many women in senior positions of leadership. I think that...
Yes, inside the public service.
Well, I'm talking about politics, so yep. The prime ministership. There's been premiers, of course. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I hope so. But politics remains still a very blokey profession, and it's tougher for women. There's no doubt about that.
Jennifer.
But they're no less capable, of course.
What I think is very interesting, and again, it goes to those... cynically call it tactical. You could also, you know, be more generous and call it the belief. But it's been very noticeable to me that Jim Chalmers, for all of these important institutions, has chosen women.
Paul?
That's very, very noticeable. The single mother, Albanese, and there's a strong sense in turn that government that some of his strongest confidants are women, and that, again, as Jennifer has just said, Reserve Bank, Productivity Commission, Secretary of Treasury, the positioning of women in those positions. And I argued after the 225 election, the feminisation of Labor, that might be an exaggeration, is part of the answer of what's going on in Australian politics today, and that shifting of the women's vote, which is a profound development in Australian politics, the movement of women leaning conservative to leaning towards, if you like, the progressive end of politics.
And women
just to add very, very quickly to
as
that.
As independents.
Sam Mostyn, of course, yep. is dramatically reshaping the office of Governor-General.
Isn't she?
And that's something to watch as well.
Isn't she? It's my great pleasure to talk to such skilled and experienced political analysts. I'm sure it's your pleasure to listen to them too. Please thank Paul Strangio, Jennifer Hewitt and Troy Bramston.
From the Sorrento Writers' Festival on Victoria's beautiful Mornington Peninsula, a massive festival over the Anzac Day weekend each year. Joining me were Troy Bramston from The Australian, whose latest political biography is called Gough Whitlam, The Vista of the New. Journalist Jennifer Hewitt is from the Australian Financial Review. Paul Strangio is Emeritus Professor in Politics at Monash University, and his latest book out this month is a ripper read, The Alchemy of Leadership, Seven Australian Prime Ministers in a Turbulent 21st Century. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Email me, bigideas@abc.net.au, or the Radio National text line is 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. We look out for your messages. Maybe add hashtag big ideas to help us see them. And I'll be back next time with more big ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.